We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musicians.
Coming to you this week from the Hollywood Hills, this is Score, the podcast. I'm your host, Kenny Holmes. It's great to be back with my co-host, Robert Kraft. What's up, Robert?
Oh, it's great to be with you, Kenny, and Matt, and be at the amazing, which is a new word I'm going to use. It's an amazing studio that we have here.
Oh, this place. Wow.
Brian Tyler's room is wonderful. It's just wonderful.
It's like a guitar center. There's so many instruments. We're surrounded by instruments.
It's like awesome. A guitar center meets Tony Stark's Iron Man lair.
Just look at all the drums. I mean,
yeah, and he's a drummer, so we're going to get a chance to ask Brian a lot of great questions about both his career, about some of the activities outside of film scoring that he's well known for, his DJing and his playing and his concerts.
Rocking out. We're also joined every week by our executive producer. You heard him over there tickling the soundboard, Matt Schrader.
Hey, guys.
Yo, hey, yo.
Kenny, tell our listeners why we should know Brian Tyler. What has he done that makes him so famous?
What hasn't he done? This guy, he doesn't sleep. Many movies. He's the maestro behind the monster Fast and the Furious franchise. Now You See Me, Thor, The Dark World, Avengers, Age of Ultron. He's a Marvel guy. Also some TV, Star Trek, Enterprise, Hawaii 5-0, and also some huge video games, Assassin's Creed, Call of Duty. That's hard to say, Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
Need for Speed. And again, he doesn't sleep. He's also an EDM DJ by night. So he's at your local club on tour, rocking a packed stage. Also coming up in today's episode, Behind the Score, featuring Oscar-winning composer Rachel Portman, plus another chance for our audience to win a sweet prize.
Fabulous prize.
Brian's going to join us and play Name That Score. And the topic this week, Matt?
The topic is robots and AI, artificial intelligence movies. There's a lot of these in the last couple decades. And
kind of perfect for Brian, too.
These sound similar, but a little different.
I'm doing the robot right now.
I like that. It's funny, and I'm going to look in the other direction just because it's also slightly
Thank
embarrassing.
Thank God this is a podcast.
I thought about some things that we were talking about just before the recording started, Kenny. I was wondering with Brian here, the whole sound of Marvel is really evolving. You look at these movies, and in some ways it may impact the way we think about Disney movies because the Disney universe contains Marvel.
Right. Well, they picked up Star Wars. They picked up Marvel. Even
Pixar.
Last week, Disneyland is now officially announced that Anaheim, Disneyland, Paris, Hong Kong, they're all putting a Marvel world into Disneyland. So yeah, it's sort of transitioning from princesses and Mickey and Minnie to superheroes.
I wonder if you'll go from listening to Snow White in one part of the park to some kind of Black Panther queue as you move towards Wakanda.
Well, and I think, you know, some of the classic Disney fans were a little up in arms when they took away the Hollywood Tower of Terror and put in the Guardians of the Galaxy ride, but that thing is sweet.
It's interesting. You always have people that are a little bit upset about something leaving and something else replacing it, but that kind of Disney sound, we definitely think of something. We think of a Disney song or a Disney, you know, Robert, you've been involved, Little Mermaid. And
yeah, Robert was part of the team that created Under the
Little Mermaid,
Sea.
But I also had the opportunity to write some theme songs for Rescue Rangers and some Disney animated, and there was a sound. You couldn't kind of go, I was tempted to go kind of, you know, punk, but I thought, I don't know why, that just didn't feel like a Disney-fied approach. So
do you feel like that sound is now evolving? Does the thing that worked 20 years ago for Disney movies so well, Does it still work, you think?
Oh, I think it's evolving because the composers are evolving. You have Giacchino doing some of these kind of films, and you have Brian Tyler doing Marvel. And as I'm sure Brian will talk about, film scoring continues to grow. It continues to embrace both cultural trends that we know, and I mean, you think about beach party movies in the 50s, they wanted a rock score, and you end up with that kind of cheap 50s beach music, and which now sounds terribly out of date, but I'm sure those summers, they thought, we're swinging, we're right in the mix. The way that we'll think that, I mean, that Black Panther score is so interesting. And yet, I wonder 20 years from today, will it feel slightly dated because something new has happened?
Well, and that's interesting to point out, too, with the way things are evolving, that these are becoming more and more concerts. I mean, Brian does concerts all the time, Brian Tyler. Also, you know, Hans Zimmer just went on a sold-out world tour. And
Hans is a rock star. He's a rock star. I saw him. I saw a couple of the shows. The one I really loved was the Shrine Auditorium here in L.A. It was a rock concert. It was sold out, and so sold out that they had barriers up in front of the shrine and policemen on horseback, like you were
composer going,
for a composer.
Like 10 years ago would have been unheard of.
The Beatles.
Matt and I, we attended. I think it was the first show of the tour. In L.A. Mm-hmm. at the Microsoft Theater?
Yeah, he played in L.A. twice. And this is, for those who haven't seen this, it's now on Netflix, this concert. It's the one that he shot in Prague.
Concert.
I think it was the same concert, you know, almost, you know, track for track, cue for cue. But it was a really impressive. If you have an opportunity to go to one of those, it's well worth it.
I think the most amazing sentence containing these two pieces of information in it could not have been said any time until this summer, where you say in the same sentence, Hans Zimmer and Coachella. And Hans, headlining America's premier music festival, says so much about where film music has gone and is going.
Oh, and I remember the news articles. I mean, there were some huge headliners there, and every big outlet was writing about Hans Zimmer, and it was a huge buzz. So hopefully that's the future, and I think it is, especially with, again, folks like Brian doing concerts and a lot of these composers putting together shows. It's a really exciting time, and I will definitely be a ticket buyer to any concert that comes
through
here.
Brian's shows are amazing because he's such a performer, and so we'll get to that. I think, Matt, in this episode, aren't we going to do a little behind the score?
We are. We have a thing with Rachel Portman in this episode.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah,
love
just
her.
One of the greats, really, and truly a pioneer too.
Some of our conversation with her in London when we visited her studio in London, which was a great experience, and we had some tea. She made some tea for us.
Did you really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think that's part of the London package.
Oh, I loved it. I wanted two cups. plenty to come on Score the Podcast coming up after the break. We're bringing him in. We're here in his studio. Brian Tyler joins us. We'll be right back.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hi, Film Score fans. Matt Schrader here from Score the Podcast. We need your support as we launch into this competitive podcast world. If you like what you're hearing, tell a friend. We're working to bring you the best guests possible from the music of the screen. Better yet, leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for telling a friend and supporting Score.
Hey, we're back with Brian Tyler, the remarkable. He's always been remarkable since the day I met him. We might even get into that story. But it's fun to catch up. See you again. See your amazing new house. I'm glad I looked at the address today because, as I said, I was probably going to point in the wrong direction and wait and wonder
where
you were.
Yeah, it's tricky. A little maze to get in here.
Yeah.
I was thinking, when was the last time I saw you? It was actually at the premiere of our film, Score the Movie, at a theater in Santa Monica.
Yeah, what theater was that, Matt?
So Lemley or Landmark?
What was the Arrow Theater?
Arrow Theater.
Santa Monica.
We want to let's start from the beginning.
Kenny had a question. I want to
jump right into this because
we're curious too.
You guys go back.
Yeah,
I've never felt less intelligent sitting in a room because I know we got two Harvard guys here.
Yeah.
But going back, I read somewhere that Robert encouraged you to go into film scoring. Yeah. Is that true?
It's absolutely true.
Is it?
Yeah. So he probably doesn't realize what this conversation at the time. So I think this was in 96. This is a few years ago.
I was 15 years old.
Yeah. So I was writing music at the time. I was back at Harvard, actually. And I had worked on a piece. There was a Requiem that got played in Boston, and I took a recording of that back with me to L.A., and I was also working on records and rock music, so I was in two worlds, classical-style, orchestra and symphonic music and rock music, which kind of has, and it makes sense, it's lasted to this day in a way. Somehow I got in with Robert to hear my music and have a sit down meeting, which was one in a million chance, and it was I really was fortunate in that way, and so I walked in and we talked about it. Was at your office at Fox, and you were working, I think, on maybe it was just, I don't know, there was a few movies you were working on at the time, and we listened to some music and you liked it.
First of all, how rare. It was obviously early in my tenure at Fox that I actually listened to a composer's music in the room with them.
Yes.
I found the danger of that was you can only say, wow, that's great.
Yeah. No,
but it was.
This was, you literally got on the phone, and before I knew it, I was over talking to Mike Gorfain.
Wow.
Sam Schwartz. Yeah.
How great.
Yeah. And
how lucky.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah.
Big agents.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was some tie-in and some good timing. There's a whole other avenue with kind of two things happening at once. And it was serendipitous, So
remind me why I felt like either you were about to score or had just scored, but I remember being excited about some music, Sword of the Samurai? Was that the name of it?
Yeah. Six String Samurai. Yeah, exactly. So I was just starting to do this indie film that was kind of a combination of Russian-style, old-school, Vogel Boatman kind of music, and exactly, and is a post-apocalyptic tale of a guy that has a guitar, so it's a wild thing. I scored a lot of it on guitar and all sorts of instruments. Anyway, that was going to Sundance, and it got a look, it got a release, and the soundtrack came out, and all this was happening at the same time as I was working on this Requiem piece, and so I had these two avenues to kind of show at least what I could do a bit, and so.
And he nudged you.
He definitely
in one direction.
I don't know. That's interesting. I think that there's occasions in your life when you are genuinely in the room with talent and you know it, and you say, to take any credit, you're just actually just helping the door open that's obviously in front of the talent. I've been there a few times where you just say, I'm the lucky person in the room to see something that's happening in front of me. It's not like that will never happen if you didn't have the goods.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'll tell you what, it was very, very good timing in a sense, because what I was talking to you a lot about at the time was I had a record deal as well, and I was going to go on tour, and I got this opportunity to do another movie as well. And I asked you about that, and it was like, one hand, the record deal is in peril if I do the movie, but the movie is in peril if I go on tour. And little did we know, Napster was right around the corner, and the record industry is about to change.
Yeah,
a heck of a lot. And so when I talk about when you've come up in conversations, Robert, before. The reason why I feel so instrumental is because I really was on the fence at the time.
I wonder.
Your words weighed in that balance.
I wonder what it was like to be in the room and hear what I responded, because I had been an artist and had moved over. But it's actually an interesting, it's something I've wanted to ask you about, which is, I knew that you were a rocker. Mm-hmm. I knew that you played drums. I remember, I think in the film, you mentioned something about listening to Led Zeppelin and Rush, your dad's records. And it always...
Yeah, when we interviewed you for Score, you brought up that...
Right.
The drums... Matt, do you have the clip from the last time we talked to you? I think we were talking about Fast Five, and you can hear you playing the drums in that score.
Oh, yeah. That's me playing. A little Calypso beat.
Yeah.
It's funny you say Calypso, because when we listen to it, I always thought it's Calypso. It's borderline, almost clave, a kind of Cuban...
So people would want to go into the tour. I mean, you are touring in other ways now, but what made you stray away from that rocker band life and go into the composing world?
Well, I mean, since I started playing instruments, there was this, you know, divide right down the middle of me. You know, I loved exactly playing Rush and Zeppelin and Sabbath and Steely Dan and everything on the drums, but I was a big Rachmaninoff, Liszt, piano, Chopin guy. So that was my jam on the other side. And so my writing styles from the time I began writing music were in two different camps pretty firmly. So there was always this balancing act of which do I pursue, but I so idolized John Williams that, you know, in so many ways, like as amazing as he's seen around the world as a composer, I've always said he's incredibly underrated.
Yeah.
I think that he's more than people even realize, which we'll be discovering for the next few hundred years. But be that as it may, that always kind of had a place in my heart at film music as... the thing that moved me the most emotionally and just from a creative standpoint. And I felt like, you know what? I can always do the rock thing because I was around it a lot. And I don't know. At the time, I thought that there was more of a horizon and expanding and being able to do it. That coincidentally, the first movie I did involved some rock music. So I thought, well, gosh, I got to get my cake and eat it too here. I can do... you know, some adagio for this scene, and I can do this breakdown rock bebop jam thing, you know.
It's perfect.
And we're, I mean, there's no shortage of drums in here. We're surrounded by drums. So.
Surrounded by drums and pianos. You got,
It's a perfect mix right down the middle.
Yeah, exactly.
In many ways, though, your conflict, you didn't realize, and often an artist doesn't realize, you were articulating what was about to happen, which is that people that understood rock and could also even knew who Rachmaninoff was. That's the money shot. Somebody who can do both, who understands filmic language and knows how to rock and knows how to go bum, 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 ta-ka-tong, ta-kong, kong, 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 kong. Because the era just prior to yours, it was either or. You had rock guys that were doing rock scores that were lame because they couldn't go beyond that.
Right.
Or orchestral guys that didn't know how to rock.
Right.
And actually, it made me wonder when I listened to that cue we just heard. Or we have something from Now You See Me. There are certain groups of musicians, I know you've recorded around the world, that knew how to rock, and certain musicians in some of the cities that I recorded in, they just didn't feel it as much. Swing was also very tough.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of, like you said, kind of being entrenched in both worlds, it's how I learned music. I think a lot of that's probably because of influence of my dad's record collection, honestly, because he was a score guy and a classical guy, but he also had, you know, Pink Floyd and Zeppelin and all that. And so I didn't really distinguish it from, I just heard it as music. So my mixtapes growing up that I would make would be, you know, John Barry, you know, and Maurice Jarre going straight into Sabbath, I didn't really realize, and I mean, as a very young kid, I didn't know that why that was maybe a little outside of the box of my friends, but I would preach the gospel of film score to my friends. I mean, since I was, you know, seven, you know, I just was like, well, listen to this record. This is hot. And it would be, you know, a De La Rue record, you know, that I got on an import, you know, or some. And so it invariably influenced how I wrote music, because I was someone that loved to write music at very young. You know, I would read books and I would kind of score them, you know, on the piano, and I'd do that. And that was my outlet. And so I almost needed those two things. And then I would love to sit down and play the guitar or cello or whatever it was. I just, I would blend it. That's why a lot of records like The Wall that used the London Symphony Orchestra, it really would hit me in the feels, because when that brass comes in and those strings on certain, you know, like on Vera, that tune, and it blended the worlds for me, and I little did I know I would end up doing that someday as my career.
Makes a huge difference.
But certainly, you know, the opportunity then to do something else that I love doing. Also, part of my dad's record collection was, you know, it was Blue Note, it was Benny Goodman, it was Glenn Miller, it was Thelonious Monk, it was Miles Davis, all that jazz. And also the soundtrack to all that jazz. That was a slip of the tongue.
Yeah.
But I remember that record too. And that's why right now doing, you know, Crazy Rich Asians, getting the opportunity to write new jazz music score that is of the 40s, 50s. It's once in a lifetime. Hopefully not once in a lifetime. I want to do it again, but certainly awesome to do.
We've got to pause for just a minute, guys. Mm-hmm. More to come with Brian Tyler. But first, Behind the Score.
Behind the Score, the inside stories from Hollywood's greatest filmmakers and composers.
During the production of Score, a film music documentary, one thing became clear. One of the traits composers seem to share is determination. Rachel Portman, more than most. In a high-stakes film industry traditionally dominated by men, she's the first woman to ever win an Oscar for original score for the 1996 film Emma.
I only consider myself as a composer that wrote music that writes music for film, not as a female composer. Or that I have a different sensibility, in a way. I mean, it may be true that I have a different sensibility because I'm a woman than a man on a film, but that doesn't mean a man can't write music that is, you know, a wonderful match for a very female subject, and vice versa with me, being able to write something that is, you know, has a much more male energy. And it's quite interesting to mix them up, I think.
Far from a fluke, Portman followed up Emma with two more Oscar nominations for Chocolat and The Cider House Rules. Even at a young age, Portman would not be denied. She pushed hard to attend an all-boys school in England, where she could further her studies.
And I went there because they had a fantastic music department there. And it was fantastic, and that's why I really started composing sort of loads and loads. I was just determined, and it was the determination that I think saw me through, because I just wasn't going to give up. I knew that's what I needed to be doing.
Portman was the first woman to win an Oscar, but the next year, another woman won the award, Ann Dudley for The Full Monty. Portman says there will be plenty more to come.
I know that there are a lot more female composers coming through, full stop. I mean, there's a lot more training and many more courses for it, and there seem to be many more composers wanting to work in the film, in the field, and you know, for that I you know, would want to encourage, you know, women to fight and come through, because we are underrepresented.
Portman earned an Emmy in 2015 for her score to the HBO film Bessie, directed by Dee Reese, and her films have to date grossed more than $1 billion at the box office. Now based in London, she remains one of the most sought-after composers in the world.
For more stories behind the score, read Score, The Interviews, based on the international hit film Score, a film music documentary featuring raw insight from Hans Zimmer, James Cameron, Quincy Jones, Randy Newman, Trent Reznor, and many more. Score,
The Interviews, available now at score-movie.com.
Hey, we're back with the amazing Brian Tyler. And speaking of amazing, Brian scored a lot of amazing movies about heroes.
Mm.
Do you think about the character and his attributes? Do you simply think about this has to sound a certain way? It's purely in the musical information. Mm. How do you write a hero's theme? You've written some great ones.
Thank you. You know, depending on the hero, it really, really is. And I didn't even realize this. I almost had to, you know, after the fact, look back and see, okay, if I felt that it worked, how did it work? And I'll give you an example of just a few contrasting heroes, even in the same universe. Like Tony Stark, Iron Man, and Thor.
I think we have Thor here. We can.
Yeah, oh, right on.
I just want to go smash someone with a hammer when I hear this every time.
Yeah, so the idea behind that is you could hear the choir that was conducting that at Abbey Road. The idea behind Thor versus Tony Stark, if you can see that was a march in 12, and it has a really kind of galloping feel, which I think evokes that, you know, horses and
hey,
and
do me a favor. I'm going to interrupt you for our listeners.
Yes.
Would you simply count the 12 out? Because I understand da-ga-da-da-ga-da, but so it'd be, how would you count out? So when you say it's a march in 12.
Yeah. And I have accents. Boom,
ding, boom, ding, ding, ding. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and so you can kind of hear the, you know, of the march of it. Now, Iron Man is in straight time. It's in 4-4, you know. And also heroic theme on brass and strings. But somehow the 12 evokes a bit of supernatural, since it harkens to this time gone past. There's something about it that sounds more godlike in a sense. Mm. Thor is not. Oh, here's Iron Man. The chords as well are more based in kind of contemporary style for Iron Man Tony, and it's because he's a human being. These people both these two superheroes both live in the Marvel universe, and it's this fantastic world where they intermix. But they're really two distinct characters. One's a guy that's a billionaire that has learned his craft and built a suit and is really clever, and the other guy is a fish out of water, son of, you know, a god who's, you know, he's a demigod, kind of coming into his own. But he has supernatural abilities, and one doesn't. And so writing these things, and even the chords and the melodies and the way the instrumentation is used and harmonization, it's all kind of one is more grounded in something that, like, blue collar in a way, even though this guy's a billionaire in a sense compared to a god.
It's more human.
It is more human, and where Thor's aspirational music, that theme sounds like, you know, it's almost out of reach. It is something we can aspire to, but we can never get to. Iron Man's attainable. You know?
What's great about the way you answered the question is you really got to the character. It's really the character that inspires it. It's not the heroic nature of it. These are two characters with two different themes.
Yeah.
I also, we always wonder about some of the other work you do. I know you're doing concerts, and I know you've done video games.
Mm. Huge video games.
Assassin's Creed Black Flag.
Yeah.
We have a piece from that. Super cool.
I gotta know, when you do a video game, do you have to create a constant loop? How is it different to prepare a video game versus a movie?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not the guy to call if they need a perfect loop. I just modulate way too much and change tempos. But the thing that's really interesting about video games is that where it used to be, I think the mindset was make it perfect, make it loop perfectly. So when you go through a scene and you're playing, you do not notice anything because it just continuously plays. But then I think I was fortunate, and when I started scoring Call of Duty and Assassin's Creed and, you know, Far Cry in these games, they became such advanced technological engines that it allowed for things like multiple ways to we would record a cue, a few different keys with different outros that I felt, and they would look to me for advice. I would say, you know what? We don't need to stay in the same key the whole time, which they would ask for by specifically when I was first offered a game, which I rejected. I won't say the name of the game. They literally were saying stay to the same key and same tempo for the entire levels.
It's like hypnotizing.
Yeah, horrible. Right. So what happened was they actually, these to their credit, they would say, well, what do you think would work? And I felt that I would keep in mind modulations upward or downward that would make sense. So you can play a game and it's really for even a level for hours, and you'll have so much more variation because you'll have different tempos and keys within even a single piece of music. And really the idea of the music playing is directed by the person playing the game. Like, I write the music, but how it's heard is different every single time.
Depending on where you go or yeah. what you're doing.
And so I've gone to EA and, EA was Electronic Arts, who's great. Mm-hmm. But I would go to all sorts of different gaming conventions and I would host
E3.
And yes, I would speak at them, and I would often watch people play games that I scored. And it was really interesting to hear my music, in a sense, remixed or yes. rearranged in a way I never would have thought of because
like a music
of how
editor.
The person just, yes, how the person played the game. And so I still do it in a natural kind of old school way, but it allows us to do that now. The game's come that far, the technology. So it allows for me not being technological.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And
the days
cool.
of the looped Mario theme are out the window, though.
It's far from that. But there was a middle ground where the games were getting very advanced and looking great, but they kind of it was baked in the cake. I think people still were thinking in a certain way. Like, you had to do it. Even when you're using orchestras and whatnot, it was still doing the loop thing. And so I just wouldn't do it. I couldn't creatively get behind doing it that way. So I think maybe the technology in a way had, and just the open-mindedness had to, we had to meet and converge where my stylistic way of writing met up with the way
love
that they
wrote it. I love it when the artist actually leads the technology in a way to say, you have to accommodate my skill set too.
Yeah.
We had one more thing. I just wanted to ask about. We were talking about it, Kenny. You want to?
Oh yeah, you're kind of a superhero, right? In the daytime, you're yes. Brian Tyler, and then at night, you put on the club mask and you're Mad Sonic.
Yeah.
Where did the name come from? First off, is that Sega related or what?
You know, I now looking back on it, it sounds like it. It's funny, and literally, minus the superhero part I've had many times where I've been conducting in the day and I literally was like, you know, I have 3 hours to get to the venue to do this, you know, music festival or something. And it's a lot of fun. It's really gratifying. I am able to do, there's an outlet there that not only widens my knowledge as I go and learn, but it informs my film scoring. There's a lot you can learn by getting up there and playing live still in front of people because there's a spontaneity that happens. And I've picked up a lot of tips watching an audience react to music and having to change in the middle of my set 35, 45 minutes in thinking, uh-oh, wait, what's going on here? And you kind of the ebb and flow. Whereas I don't sit in the theater until I've already done my work for a film to really realize how it works. But it is amazing how I think music, regardless of the genre, affects human beings in a way.
Does that electronic sound come into your... So like for Fast... What was the clip? Fast 7. It sounded a lot more electronic. It had a similar... beat to it. Do you have that clip, Matt?
Yeah.
It does depend.
Does it? And so the palette of EDM, you feel right. It creeps into film scores?
It does sometime. And I would say Fast and Furious is a good example. Sometimes it's a total hybrid, like Power Rangers, which was very much an orchestral score. Oh, here we go. Orchestra and...
This has a little EDM feel to it.
It's like a crushed beat. It's a halftime kind of almost future bass beat. And then, and it has kind of trap hi-hats. And so some of the production does come in on certain films. And it's by whatever it is by design. For instance, I'm doing something with Taylor Sheridan, the writer of Sicario and whatnot. And it's interesting because the approach is completely opposite, where if it doesn't go through a microphone and it's not acoustic, it's not part of the score, and there's no percussion either. It's actually like strings and kind of, you know, so it kind of depends on the project. I like actually creating restrictions to what I do on a score. In other words, I often start a score and think, I am not going to use any instrument that is here or over here. And so it restricts me and it frees me up. If you can use any instrument all the time, I think it just becomes a wall of beige. You don't need to use everything all the time. In fact, choose your orchestra size even wisely. Sometimes 28 strings or 28 members of the orchestra is better, and sometimes 100 is better. Sometimes 45 is better. And sometimes no electronics is better. And that's what we did on Crazy Rich Asians. It was like, could we record this score in 1940? If yes, then do it.
And with that, we got to take a quick break. Coming up after the break, though, we're going to play Name That Score. What's the topic again, Matt?
Robots and AI movies. Oh. We're going to put you to the test.
You're going to win a prize for some lucky listener.
Oh boy.
It's possible. We'll be right back.
Hey, Matt Schrader here, director of Score of Film Music Documentary. For the latest news from the film music world, follow us on Facebook. Just search Score of Film Music Documentary. Or let us know who you want to hear next on the show on Twitter, at Score the Podcast.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast. We're inside the studios of Brian Tyler, and we're about to jump right in. It's time to play.
We have to say it. Ready?
Name
that score.
Hit it, Matt.
Get ready to play Name That Score!
Oh, dear.
It's a film music game where a perfect score means you, yes, you, could be a winner. Now let's play Name That Score!
Matt's going to freelance over at Price is Right.
So here's how this works. We play five famous scores, but in reverse. You'll choose from three multiple choice answers. The fifth and final question is worth double. If anybody gets all five questions right, we give away a prize on our Twitter account, at Score the Podcast. Just mention hashtag Name That Score.
Right on.
And because the best scores have a theme, so does this game. Today's theme is robots and AI movies.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man.
Brian, one of these may sound familiar.
Oh,
yeah. I think Brian did a couple.
I won't give anything away. But we'll go through these. We got five questions. First question here, I'll give you the options first. Is this, and remember it's backwards, is this RoboCop, Pacific Rim, or The Terminator?
Oh, it's backwards. That's the Terminator backwards. Brad Fidel.
Terminator.
Yeah.
Oh, well, if he's that confident.
First of all, Brian says that's Terminator. I was thinking, how in the world, this is really a drag for Brian. He's going to have to, and then he said right away, Terminator backwards. So I'm definitely going with Terminator backwards.
Let's all just, yeah.
Everybody's going Terminator?
Yes.
That's awesome.
All right.
Yeah. Well, that started off.
I think I'm just whatever Brian says. I'm saying yes.
We're gonna make Robert go first here now,
oh, shoot.
So he doesn't,
please, God.
Doesn't copy anyone.
Wait, so am I speaking out of turn? I'm not supposed to just like shout it out.
You're supposed to shout it out.
Oh, okay.
Well, It depends on how whether Robert recognizes it or not.
No, I think that I want Brian to shout out.
Robert's been known to just go with everyone.
So are we a team or are we a team?
I like the team approach. I didn't know
if you want to win or not.
Competitive.
Someone will win if one of us gets all of them right. So if you're sure,
I'm going to give Brian that one.
We do want someone to win though. So if you're real sure, yeah,
that's definitely Brian.
Confidently shout.
Question two.
I'll go first.
I'm not sure whether that's the
fire away.
All right, Robert's is going to go first.
I'm saying the Flintstones theme.
Here is question.
A classic AI movie.
Go ahead.
Flintstones. Question two. Is this WALL-E, Blade Runner, or Westworld?
Oh,
Brian's raising his hand again.
I know it.
It's definitely not WALL-E. And I've listened, of course. You didn't say Blade Runner 2049 or original.
Evangelis.
Because I'm going with Evangelis, Blade Runner. No, thank you. I'm hearing a
that
negative.
Is true. I'm going, Robert, you got it.
I was thinking.
Blade Runner.
Yes, it's Blade Runner. Okay.
All right.
It was Blade Runner.
We're all two for two here. So these
can you play it? I want to hear it. Do you have
too
it?
Easy. Here we go.
That sounds better. Much better forward.
Yeah.
And I'm taking the guess because that's such a Vangelis-sounding synth sound.
CS-80.
That was what...
Yamaha CS-80.
That is what gave it away. Okay.
So yes. Points for... we're perfect so far. Two for two for everybody. Question three, is this Tron Legacy, Transformers, or...
Oh, I got to go
the
first.
Original Iron Man.
Oh, man, now everyone's 100% pressure's on me. I'm going to go Transformers.
Kenny says Transformers.
I'm going to go with our guest of the episode. I'm feeling Brian Tyler on Iron Man.
Well, the original Iron Man is Ramin Djawadi.
It's Ramin, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I'm going with...
Brian would have heard that.
Yeah.
If
exactly.
Yeah, okay. I feel like he would have shouted.
I'm going with Iron Man.
Robert?
Oh yeah, Iron Man. It's Iron Mensch.
Transformers.
Oh. We all missed it.
Kenny got it.
I got it.
Kenny
got it.
Full disclosure, points. I was just going with the body language at the table thinking they're kind of leaning towards Iron Man over at that side.
Yeah.
I'm going with it. I have no idea.
I have the social media
that's
backing
good.
Now.
That's crazy when you hear it forward.
I can run it.
Everybody's rooting for Kenny because if he gets the last ones, then we give away a prize.
Here
all right,
go.
Question four. Is this AI, Artificial Intelligence by John Williams, Big Hero 6 by Henry Jackman, or Star Wars?
Well, I have a guess.
I'm trying to think of the first choice was.
Is this AI, Artificial Intelligence?
That's not AI.
Big Hero 6.
I don't think it's Star Wars.
I'm going to go Big Hero 6.
Six. Yeah.
I'm going
just
Henry
out of
Jackman.
Process of elimination.
Same.
Everybody?
No.
Yep. Big Hero 6 good. By Henry Jackman.
Oh, man. The pressure's on. This is like bottom
great
of the ninth.
For animated movie. All right,
okay, good.
Last question. Here we go. This question is worth double. Not that it matters, really.
So
but
is it,
you guys,
is any of us, to that we need to be sure amongst ourselves.
Well,
that
so this
idea?
Is tricky. We have a scenario here where if Kenny gets this one right, he of course wins the game, and we give away a prize. If he loses, and one
first.
Of you guys get it, you get 2 points, so you win the game, but no one wins a prize.
Oh,
so
gosh.
We'll see here.
We may give away a prize just for grins.
We might do it just anyway.
Just an In-N-Out burger.
Check our score the podcast. All right, question five. Is this Real Steel by James Horner, I, Robot, or The Matrix?
Oh, I definitely know
I know this.
This,
yeah. So you go with it because it is the I'm not gonna say it. I want you to may the. I want you to go so because surprise
the Matrix.
There we go.
Hey. All right.
Almost sounds the same backwards.
Isn't that interesting? We played it backwards the first time, but it sounds so similar.
Yeah.
What is it when a word is the same backwards as forward?
A palindrome.
Palindrome.
Yeah. Madam,
palindrome score. Yeah, Harvard guys.
I'll tell you what. What's the longest palindrome you can think of?
Is it the canal one?
That's a palindrome. A palindrome, one word.
Oh, now we're in a whole new show here.
I'd like to know.
Harvard palindrome. I'm going to go with new on podcast.
Rotavator.
You know what? I didn't bring my Rotavator today, but
I'm going to take the first Rotavator out of here.
Vintage Rotavator.
All right. That's so our winner of that game is none other than Kenny Holmes.
Kenny Holmes. Bam, dun, dun, dun,
dun. I'm glad That's you got so nice. Rid of the
Our
fireworks noise.
Cause loves it.
The fireworks noise sounded just like we had a bad cable. I'm glad you got rid of that one.
Yeah. Now we get a drum roll.
That is a very interesting choice of topic to AI and robots. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
It's a very new genre.
New genre.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up here.
I'm kind of exhausted after the game because it's very, very taxing.
Yeah, that was stressful.
Think backwards. But I've learned somehow the only thing I know about this game after playing it now a few times is that John Williams forward and backwards fills up the airspace in a way that no one else does.
Right.
It just is. You feel it when a John Williams score comes on. The whole room seems full of brass and French horns, and it's so distinct, even backwards. Yep.
All right. Well, just a quick reminder, this is a new show, and we're trying to get the word out. So please jump on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Share us. Subscribe to us, tell a friend.
Spotify podcast too.
I want to thank Brian Tyler. Brian, our fans can find you on social media at Brian Tyler Music.
Yeah, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that good
jump
stuff.
Jump on there.
Yeah.
Also, if you want to check out Score, a film music documentary, which features Brian among other fabulous composers, go to score-movie.com and you can pick that up.
Thanks, Kenny. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks all.
Brian.
Right on.